The name Lord Harab was tarnished with the slur of treason. Your father was hounded to a traitor's death. You have proven your father's innocence. I rescind all sentences passed against Pianchi, Lord Harab, and posthumously restore to him all his honours and titles that were stripped from him. Those honours and titles descend to you, his son. Bakr! Shouted the congregation. May Pharaoh live forever. Hail Tanos, Lord Harab! In addition to those titles which now come down to you as your inheritance, I bestow upon you new distinction. You have carried out my charge to you. You have destroyed the shrikes and delivered their overlord to justice. In recognition of this service to the crown, I bestow upon you the gold of valour. Kneel, Lord Harab, and receive the king's favour. Bakr! They cried, as Pharaoh placed the jangling gold chains that had so recently belonged to Lord Intef, but to which he had now added the star pendant of the warrior's decoration about Tanos' neck. Hail, Lord Harab! As Tanos withdrew, Pharaoh turned his attention back to the prisoners. Lord Intef, you are deprived of your title as a lord of the Theban circle. Your name and rank will be erased from all the public monuments, and from your tomb that you have prepared in the Valley of the Nobles. Your estates and all your possessions, including your illicit treasure, are forfeited to the crown, except only those estates that once belonged to Pianchi, Lord Harab, and which by fell means have come into your possession. These are now returned in their entirety to his heir, my goodly Tanos, Lord Harab. Bakr! Pharaoh is wise, may he live for ever! The people cheered wildly, and beside me my mistress was weeping unashamedly. But then so were half the royal women. Very few of them could resist that heroic figure, whose golden hair seemed to dim the chains upon his breast. Now the king took me by surprise. He looked directly at where I sat beside my mistress. There is one other who has done the crown loyal service, the one who revealed the whereabouts of the stolen treasure. Let the slave Taita stand forth. I went down to stand before the throne, and the king's voice was gentle. You have suffered unspeakable harm at the hands of the traitor Intef and his henchman Rasfa. You have been forced by them to commit nefarious deeds and capital crimes against the state, by conniving with bandits and robbers, and by concealing your master's treasure from the royal tax collectors. However, these were not crimes of your own inspiration. As a slave, you were forced to the will of your master. Therefore, I absolve you from all guilt and liability. I find you innocent of any crime, and I reward you for your service to us with a bounty of 2 tucks of fine gold to be paid out of the treasure confiscated from the traitor Intef. A murmur of astonishment greeted this announcement, and I gasped aloud. It was a staggering amount, a fortune to match those of all but the wealthiest lords in the land, enough to buy great tracts of the most fertile land along the river, and to furnish magnificent villas upon that land, to buy 300 strong slaves to work the land, enough to fit out a fleet of trading vessels and send them to the ends of the earth to bring back more treasure. It was a sum large enough to boggle even my imagination, but the king had not finished. As a slave, this bounty will be paid not to you, but to your mistress, the Lady Lostris, who is a junior wife of Pharaoh. I should have guessed that Pharaoh would keep it in the family. I, who for a fleeting moment had been one of the richest men in Egypt, bowed to the king and returned to my place beside my mistress. She squeezed my hand to console me, but in truth I was not unhappy. Our destinies were so entwined that I was a part of her, and I knew that we would never again want for any material thing. I was already planning how I would invest my mistress's fortune for her. At last the king was ready to pass sentence on the line of prisoners, though he looked only at Intef as he spoke. Your crimes are unparalleled. No punishment before meted out is harsh enough to fit your case. This, then, is the sentence I pass upon you. At dawn on the day after the end of the festival of Osiris, you will be marched through the streets of Thebes bound and naked. While you still live, you will be nailed by your feet to the main gate of the city, with your heads hanging downwards. You will be left there until your bones are picked clean by the crows. Then your bones will be taken down and ground to powder and cast into Mother Nile. Even Intef paled and swayed on his feet as he listened to the sentence. By dispersing their earthly bodies so that they could never be embalmed and preserved, Pharaoh was condemning the prisoners to oblivion. For an Egyptian, there could be no harsher punishment. They were being denied, for all eternity, the fields of paradise. When my mistress expressed her determination to attend the executions and to watch her father being nailed upside down to the main gate, I do not think that she truly realized the horror of what she would witness. I was equally determined that she should not be there to see it. There had never been a sadistic streak in her. I believe that her decision was influenced by the fact that most of the other royal women were going to enjoy the diverting spectacle, and that Tunnus would be in command of the execution. She would never pass up an opportunity to gaze at him, even from a distance. In the end, I persuaded her only by employing the most poignant argument in my arsenal. My lady, such cruel sights as these will certainly affect your unborn son. Surely you do not wish to blight this young, unformed mind. That is not possible, she faltered for the first time in our argument. My son could know nothing of it. He will see through your eyes, and the screams of his dying grandfather will pass through the walls of your stomach and enter his tiny ears. It was an evocative choice of words, and they had the effect I was striving for. She thought about it at length and then sighed. Oh, very well, then, but I shall expect you to bring me back a full description of it all. You are not to miss a single detail. Especially I will want to know what the other royal wives were wearing. Then she grinned at me wickedly, to prove that she had not been totally gulled by my arguments. You can whisper it all to me, so the child sleeping in my belly cannot overhear us. At dawn on the day of the execution, the gardens of the palace were still shrouded in darkness when I left the harem. I hurried through the water gardens, and the stars were reflected in the black surfaces of the ponds. As I approached the wing of the palace where Lord Intef was being held in his own quarters, I saw the blaze of torches and lamps lighting the windows and heard the frantic yelling of orders and invective from within. I knew instantly that something was seriously amiss, and I broke into a run. I was almost speared by the guard at the door to Lord Intef's private quarters, but he recognized me at the last moment before he skewered me and lifted his weapon and let me pass. Tunnus was in the centre of the antechamber. He was roaring like a black-maned lion in a trap, and aiming blows with his clenched fists at whoever came within range. Even though he had always had a stormy temper, I had never before seen him so incapacitated by rage. He seemed to have lost the power of reason or of articulate speech. His men, those mighty heroes of the Blues, cowered away from him, and the rest of the palace wing was in an uproar. I went straight up to him, ducked under another wild punch, and shouted in his face, "Tunnus, it is I, control yourself. In the name of all the gods, are you mad?" He almost struck me, and I saw him wrestle with his emotions, and at last take control of them. "See what you can do for them." He pointed at the bodies that were scattered about the antechamber, as though a battle had raged through it. With horror, I recognized that one of them was Ketket, a senior captain of the regiment and a man I respected. He was curled in the corner, clutching his stomach with such agony etched on his rigid features that I hoped never to see again. I touched his cheek, and the skin was cold and dead. I shook my head. He is past all help that I can give him. I lifted his eyelid with my thumb and gazed into his dead eye. Then I leaned forward and smelled his mouth. The faint, musty odour of mushrooms on it was dreadfully familiar. "Poison," I stood up. "The others will be the same." There were five of them curled on the tiles. "How?" asked Tunnus, in a tone of forced calm, and I picked up one of the bowls piled on the low table from which they had obviously eaten their dinner, and I sniffed it. The smell of mushrooms was stronger. "Ask the cooks," I suggested. Then, in a sudden access of anger, I hurled the bowl against the wall. The crumpled bodies reminded me of my pets who had died the same death, and Ketket had been my friend. I took a deep breath to calm myself before I asked, "No doubt your prisoner has escaped." Tunnus did not reply, but led me through into the Grand Vizier's bedchamber. Immediately I saw the painted panel that had been removed from the far wall of the empty room, and the opening behind it. "Did you know that there was a secret passage?" Tunnus demanded coldly, and I shook my head. I thought I knew all his secrets, but I was wrong. My voice was resigned. I think that in my heart I had known all along that we would never bring Intef to justice. He was a favourite of the dark gods and enjoyed their protection. "Has Rasfer escaped with him?" I asked, and Thanos shook his head. "I have him locked in the arsenal with the barons. But Intef's two sons, Menset and Sobek, have disappeared. Almost certainly they were the ones who arranged the murder of my men and their father's escape." Thanos had full control of that wild temper of his once more, but his anger was still there beneath it. "You know Intef so well, Taita. What will he do? Where will he go? How can I catch him?" "One thing I know, he will have made plans against such a day as this. I know he has treasure stored for him in the Lower Kingdom, with merchants and lawyers there. He has even had commerce with the false pharaoh. I think that he sold military information to him and his generals. He would receive a friendly welcome in the north. I have already sent 5 fast galleys to the north with orders to search all vessels that they overtake," Thanos told me. "He has friends across the Red Sea," I said, "and he has sent treasure to merchants in Gaza on the shores of the northern sea to be held for him. He has had dealings with the Bedouin. Many of them are in his pay. They would help him to cross the desert." "By Horus, he is like a rat with a dozen escape routes to his hole," swore Thanos. "How can I cover all of them?" "You cannot," I said. "And now Pharaoh is waiting to witness the executions. You will have to report this to him. The king will be angry, and with good reason. By allowing Intef to escape, I have failed in my duty." But Thanos was wrong. Pharaoh accepted the news of Intef's escape with remarkable equanimity. I cannot fathom the reason for this, except perhaps that the vast quantity of treasure he had acquired so unexpectedly had mellowed him. Deep in his heart he may still have cherished some sneaking affection for his grand vizier. On the other hand, Pharaoh was a kindly man and may not have truly relished the prospect of watching Lord Intef being nailed to the city gates. It is true he showed some passing annoyance and spoke of justice being cheated, but all the time we were in his presence he was surreptitiously studying the manifest of the treasure. Even when Thanos admitted his responsibility for his prisoner's escape, Pharaoh brushed it aside. "The fault lies with the captain of the guard, and he has already been sufficiently punished from the poison bowl that Intef provided for him. You have sent galleys and troops in pursuit of the fugitive. You have done all that can be expected of you, Lord Harrop. It remains only for you to carry out my sentence on these other criminals." "Is Pharaoh ready to witness the execution?" Thanos asked. And Pharaoh looked about him for an excuse to remain with his manifests and tax collectors' reports. "I have much to do here, Lord Thanos. Proceed without me. Report to me when the sentences have been carried out." So great was the public interest in the executions that the city fathers had erected a Taita stand in front of the main gates. They charged a silver ring for a seat upon it. There was no lack of customers, and the stand was packed to capacity. The crowds who could not find a seat upon it overflowed out into the fields beyond the walls. Many of them had brought beer and wine to make a celebration of it, and to toast the barons on their way. Very few of them had not suffered from the ravages of the shrikes, and many of them had lost husbands or brothers or sons to them. Stark naked and bound together, as Pharaoh had ordered, the condemned men were led through the streets of Karnak. The crowd lined their way and hurled dung and filth at them as they passed, screaming insults and shaking their fists. The children danced ahead of the procession, singing bits of doggerel made up on the spur of the moment. "Nails in my tooties, bare bun to the sky, I am a baron, and that's how I die." Obedient to my mistress's wishes, I had taken up a place on the stand to watch the sentence carried out. In truth, I had no eyes for the clothing and jewellery of the women of fashion around me when the prisoners were at last led through the open gates. I looked instead at Rasfer, and I tried to revive and inflate my hatred for him. I forced myself to recite every cruel and wicked act that he had ever committed against me, to relive the agony of the lash and the knife that he had inflicted upon me. Yet there he stood with his white belly sagging almost to his knees, with excrement in his hair and filth streaking his face and running down his grotesque body. It was difficult to hate him as much as he deserved. He saw me on the stand, and he grinned up at me. The paralysed muscles on one side of his face made it only half a grin, a sardonic grimace, and he called, Thank you for coming to wish me Godspeed, eunuch. Perhaps we will meet again in the fields of paradise, where I hope to have the pleasure of cutting off your balls once again.